Before we jump into the episode, we'd like to provide a content warning. This episode looks at prostitution, and we touch on topics such as human trafficking, exploitation, and sex. As much as these are important topics to discuss, feel free to pause or skip ahead if the topics get too heavy for you. We have also added resources you can check out in the description area if you or someone you know may need help.
Hello, hello, hello! Welcome to Season 4 of SG Explained. My name is Ali. I'm so glad to be with you guys again. And joining me as always, my favorite co-host of all time, Mr. Rovic. How are you doing,
man? Season 4, wow, can you imagine it? It's been such a journey to get here.
Yeah, we have so much more to give this season.
I mean, we're coming off, you know, having produced a Challenge Asia episode. We just went live, I think, 2 weeks ago, and we've been getting a lot of buzz from, you know, both our community members as well as new folks who've just been streaming in. If you are a new listener, then welcome, welcome. We're glad for you to join our community. You know, Season 4 is going to be exciting, so you're in at the right time.
As with the episodes that have gone by, Rovic and I have gained a lot more experience, so we're leveling up again this season. And we're going to be tackling a lot of, hopefully more spicy topics for you guys, since the feedback given from the CNA, you know, episode was very, very positive. So I think it's really encouraged us to try to push the limits a little bit more every episode at a time.
Speaking of pushing the limits, I feel like that's why, Elliot, you chose today's episode as our season opener. We couldn't get enough of the vice in Singapore.
Exactly. You know, Rovic and I were sitting, we were planning for season 4, right? And we were sitting along Geylang.
Yeah.
And we were along Geylang and we were eating like Tau Wei. This was before when we could. Right now we're in phase 2 heightened alert, so we can't. But when we could, we sat there and had discussions about, hey, how do we plan episodes for season 4? That's when it hit me. You know, why don't we talk about prostitution? I mean, we were sitting literally in the heart of it in Singapore, and I thought, why don't we take a historical lens, study it a little bit closer, and see how it's evolved. And it's not that it's eradicated in today, right? Like, right now in Singapore, prostitution is still a thing. We all know it to be true.
Well, it's legal.
It's legal, exactly.
That's a big surprise that a lot of people have when they come to Singapore, because the common tropes that are associated with Singapore, it's a clean country, there's a strong rule of law, we're very conservative.
We're usually very anti-vice.
In a sort of a progressive way, we've legalized prostitution as a way to have control over it and as a way to be able to monitor the effects that it's having. It's definitely an interesting part of our national identity, and it I think it's worth exploring, you know, why we regulated instead of outright banning it, and then what are some of the, you know, downstream implications of that, and how are we responding to changing trends right around the world. So there's a lot that we can definitely unpack today.
I could not summarize that any better myself, Rovic. Welcome to today's episode. Let's jump right in. In several government regulated red light districts, Indonesians, Filipino, Vietnamese, Malaysian, Thais, Indians, and Chinese women legally pursue customers in like brothels, karaoke lounges, and massage parlors. But they are required to carry health cards and submit to like medical checks regularly. However, soliciting for sex on the street is illegal. So you can't, you know, have someone just come up to your car in the middle of a red light and just be like, knock, knock, would you like a good time. In places like the top 10 disco in the early 2000s, mostly expatriate men rendezvous with Thai prostitutes. And even in the mid-2000s, private social escort firms openly advertised the services of young, energetic, and intelligent girls in their 20s, you know, for about what? The price was $150 to $200 an hour, or even $1,000 a night. So this was something that we took from The Star back in 2006, reported by Xia Cheng Ni. Note that today's episode, all the references to prostitution relate to commercial sex between a male and a female, because currently all forms of male-male, or in this case also including like transgender males, that sort of sex in Singapore remains like a criminal offense under Section 377A of the Penal Code. So maybe we'll talk a little bit more about what prostitution, or like what the consensus of prostitution is like, is in today's setting. So Philip Lim of Agence France Press wrote that Singapore has been perceived as like a conservative, you know, something you alluded to just now, even prudish city-state, but it has a thriving sex industry dating back to its beginnings as a key trading port of the British Empire. Now, brothels openly operate in Singapore in the notorious, you know, Geylang Red Light District, and self-declared prostitutes are required to undergo health checks. While prostitution is legal in Singapore, soliciting for customers isn't, and offenders may be fined as much as 2,000 Singapore dollars or jailed for as long as 6 months, according to the city-state's statutes. Now, this is, once again, taken in 2012 by Philip Lim from Agence France Press. So, Rovik, maybe you can help us define what is prostitution according to the Women's Charter.
So, the two key laws that look at these are the Women's Charter and the Penal Code. According to the Women's Charter, prostitution is defined as the act of a female offering her body for sexual penetration for hire, whether in money or in kind. And this is also known as commercial sex, right? So it's, again, focused on males and females, and it's very narrowly defined. In Singapore today, according to a 2015 study conducted by the Saw Swee Hock School of Public Health, there are approximately 4.2K female sex workers in Singapore. So that's a decent amount of sex workers who are basically here, and they fall under this definition. Now, we've also talked about solicitation and pimping, right? So let's maybe define that a bit. Pimping is also technically known as procurement of prostitutes. And procurement of prostitutes involves the arrangement of a prostitute to engage in a sexual act with a customer. So the procurer normally acts as an agent and collects part of their earnings, and they tend to also be involved in human trafficking, right? Like they are basically in the industry of exploiting people.
Procuring a prostitute in the definition also involves trafficking most of the time, right? So trafficking is against the law.
Yes, exactly. And so because Singapore takes a hard stance against trafficking, then they basically focus on pimping as a way to stamp out trafficking rather than to focus on prostitution itself. So soliciting by prostitutes is prohibited under Section 19 of the Miscellaneous Offences, Public Order and Use an act, which states that every person who is in a public road or public place persistently loiters or solicits for the purpose of prostitution or any other immoral purpose shall be guilty of an offense. So this is mostly in the realm of public nuisance, and it's to maintain probably the decorum and, I guess, dignity of public places in Singapore, and to avoid, you know, vice activities spilling into mainstream Singapore. So essentially, the only form of prostitution that is legal in Singapore is a prostitution that's confined to designated areas. And in these cases, they tend to be brothels, in which there is basically the absence of procurers, right, or pimps. The Singapore government takes a pragmatic approach to prostitution. Instead of closing down the sex industry, it aims to tightly regulate the trade to protect minors and ward off criminal involvement. Singapore's legislation of the sex trade makes it a pragmatic and unusual exception in a region where prostitution thrives, but is officially banned, said Ruben Wong, a political scientist at NUS. Now, he continued on to say that he recognizes that it's not possible to eradicate and force it underground, as there will be a greater likelihood of involvement by triads and organized crime and the trafficking of women and public health risk. And we saw some of this in our recent Secret Society special episode, right, where we already saw that even all the way back in the early 1900s or even before that, just prostitution was already a big thing in Singapore, just because of the nature of the trade in Singapore, the nature of human flows and trade
and
flows.
It
was a business, because you had all these coolies who were all males here, and they had no families, and basically prostitutes was the only way that they could get some kind of relief, right? So essentially, prostitution was legalized to bring the sector under close government control for economic, moral, and tax reasons. And the main overarching theme across the board, and we'll hear it repeatedly today, is government control. By having a registered set of prostitutes, these 4,200, right, you are able to monitor their health, right, to see if they have any STDs. You also are able to localize it to specific regions, and you also maintain the public order through that. So there's a couple of elements that government control achieves without, you know, putting it underground instead.
When we talk about regulationism later on, there is a lot of this idea of trying to to not spread a disease. They always say prostitution is like the oldest trade, right? It's more of like, how can we not make it a public health hazard? So maybe we'll start really early on, during a time where Britain's development of Singapore into an international entrepôt during the first half of the 19th century changed well-established trading patterns and brought both like this demand and supply for commercial sex to Singapore itself. Our development as a hub for British power in the later half of like the 19th century, right, offered employment opportunities for millions of unattached male labourers from around the world. That's exactly what we were talking about in the last episode. And at the same time, I think the colony became a primary distribution centre for trade in women and girls who provided these labourers with highly sought after domestic and sexual services. So what we saw was that by the 1870s, at the height of the controversy surrounding Britain's contagious disease ordinances, the colonial state had grown large enough to enforce its legislation, and Singapore's government attempted to regulate the local sex industry. However, Singapore was already like this key center for what was a sophisticated and intricately organized and highly prosperous underground network. And colonial officials struggled unsuccessfully to curb it. Of course, you know, back in the day, it was, we talked about how there was always a power struggle between like the local clans and British colonial government, right?
I mean, basically it was so pervasive and there was almost no way to exert control.
Yeah, absolutely. So by this point, right, women regularly traveled to, or sometimes they were, of course, they were smuggled into the colony's notoriously accommodating brothel districts from around the globe. So when Raffles kind of like founded modern Singapore as a British trading settlement in 1819, you know, we know that migrants poured in from China, India, Malaya. And as those number of migrants increased, which were overwhelmingly male settling areas around Chinatown, brothels became an important outlet for the sexual needs. These migrants, or the term that they used was Sinkies, came to Singapore, or Silat Po, which was our old Chinese name.
I didn't even know we had a Chinese name called Silat Po.
From my research, I found that this is the name that was used when touting these women to come into Singapore.
Oh.
They had no idea what Singapore was back in the day. So in promising them that it was like, oh, this whole new world out there where they can make a living, they would call us Silat Po. Yeah, these migrant workers, you know, they came to Singapore and without their wives, they found solace in the arms of Aku. So Aku is this word that we'll use quite a fair bit for the Chinese prostitutes. When it comes to the prostitution in Singapore after 1860, comes from this particular professor named Professor James Warren, who is a professor of history and Southeast Asian studies at Murdoch University. Basically, two camps of prostitutes, okay, that I think were the most dominant. We know that there were a lot of other like nationals, right? There were Thais, there were Indonesians who were coming in. But by and large, the two big camps that we'll see as slightly problematic later on were the Chinese Akus and the Japanese Karayuki, who worked in the city's sex industry during the height of British regulationism between 1864 and 1888. And it will spill on later into like the two world wars. In addition to the Akus and the Japanese Karayuki-sans, Warren's work also provides important insight into Singapore's commercial sex trade and describes the environments of its eastern and western sectors. So the eastern district contained almost as many European prostitutes, right? And I quote, respectable colonial female population was living in nearby residential areas. So since the colonial government maintained like a strict ban on British women working as prostitutes in its eastern colonies, such as Singapore, most were poor women from Central and Eastern Europe, mainly from Hungary and Poland. There were some like Russian Jewesses, as well as a few French and German women as well. So yet, according to Warren, European women had a notorious reputation for being like loud, foul-mouthed streetwalkers who assumed privilege as courtesans of a superior race and made them behave in a manner that appeared gross and vulgar to local authorities. And in contrast, one colonial officer lauded the quiet charm of the native women. I'm quoting that there's a lot of air quotes going around because I'm not saying these things by myself. The European women generally arrived with their sortenaire or their pimp who sold their wares in open inverted commas to passersbys. And they solicited from doorways and street corners where five or six girls worked in a brothel servicing a variety of clients, primarily at that time, British or other Europeans in like these narrow cubicles. So you can think of it. If we actually, there are like drawings depicting this, but it kind of looks like strip club booths. The demand of these women was created almost entirely by European residents, merchants, or tourists visiting the port.
It was about servicing the British, who were basically there also as migrants in their own ways, right? They were there to work and keep the port going for themselves. And of course, they too were away from their wives, or maybe, you know, they felt like they were in a foreign land and they could do whatever they want. And I guess that created a demand for European women. But, you know, there's so much getting triggered for me right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Between the fact that, oh, like, even back then we had colonial separation between, you know, European women and women from the region, the Asian region. And then when you mentioned that the colonial officer lauded the quiet charm of Native women, that's, you know, there's so much prejudice and colonial lenses just coming out from that, right? And
absolutely. One of the shows that I watched in preparation for this episode was this movie called The Sleeping Dictionary. I don't know if you heard of it, but it's actually Jessica Alba is inside. She plays a local Native woman who is basically a prostitute who teaches a colonial how to speak a native language, because what they would do is, you know, they would spend so much time with them that they would try to learn the local languages through prostitution. It really portrayed, and of course it's told in the perspective of a colonial, right? It looks to almost exoticize like the local native woman or the Southeast Asian woman back in the day. There is a lot that's going on here. On one hand, these prostitutes, the Akus and the Karayuki-san who were coming over, they were looking for jobs. They were looking for a way of making money. Singapore became a hub, not because of local demand, but because of this strange amalgamation of like, hey, everyone was going to converge in Singapore. Let's have a local sex scene, like a local commercial sex scene.
You know, just to be able to connect the dots a bit better. This is a trend that persists till today, and we'll see that later on, where even till today, some of the concerns around trafficking and some of the reasons why prostitution is still so rampant in some ways is because of that same branding that Singapore has as a hub, as a place to, you know, connect with the world. And women get tricked into coming into Singapore, and then they get tricked into being prostitutes. And it's a very unfortunate and very, very dangerous trade that happens, and Singapore unfortunately is at the heart of it because of our hub status. So, you know, not to jump the gun too fast, but I just wanted to say that a lot of what we're seeing in the past doesn't just stay in the past. It continues all the way.
No, the roots grow deep. The roots definitely grow deep in this one.
In response to an epidemic of venereal diseases that began in the 1860s, the colonial government began legislative efforts to contain and regulate the commercial sex industry in the name of public health. The passage of Singapore's local contagious disease ordinance in 1870, or the CDO, marked the beginning of Singapore's enduring legislative struggle with the realities of a thriving commercial sex industry and the social, ethical, and political consequences of maintaining it. The colonial authorities had already created a system to catalog the various brothels within their business registry in the 1850s, and the CDO granted officials the legal authority to interrogate, examine, and detain women known for or suspected of working as prostitutes. Initially, women and brothel owners throughout Singapore resisted and avoided the government system of examinations and detainment, but within a few years, incidences of disease diminished and prostitutes began going to the examinations voluntarily. Officials also noticed a leveling off in the opening of new brothels, and many argued that regulationism was noticeably successful in reducing incidences of syphilis and gonorrhea, and it gave officials the authority to offer assistance to victims who had been trafficked or were being abused. Still, there were overwhelming evidence showed that in parts of England and in some British colonies, there were officials who misused the authority granted by the Contagious Diseases Act to terrorize middle and working class women. Consequently, anti-prostitution and anti-trafficking activists fought hard to abolish what they saw a blatant exploitation of working women and girls, and in 1888, Parliament repealed the Imperial Contagious Disease Ordinance. It's an interesting evolution, I would say, of how regulation was used.
This is some of my own thoughts synthesized as well, was that the reason why they had to do this whole clamping down, they had to do like create a system to catalog the various brothels. It was not because there was a local problem in the sense, you know, locals, whether it was Chinese or the indigenous people who were getting these diseases, but it was spread throughout the British community. And most of these women who were in the service of prostitution, they were working with the colonial government back then. It only made a lot more sense that they had to clamp it down for their own health. It's a very self-serving sort of narrative that we're seeing here.
So in spite of vocal objections by Singapore's officials, residents, and the medical community, the colonial government, wary of public censure, ordered a mandatory registration and examination systems be dismantled and all women detained in locked hospitals be released. However, to mitigate the effects of the repeal from 1889 to 1927, unbeknownst to the British public, Singapore's officials expanded the role and authority of the Chinese protectorate, who, if we remember, was William Pickering, right? Through legal measures pertaining to the Protection of Women and Girls Ordinance to allow for the maintenance of an extra legal system of publicly recognized houses. This period of quasi-regulation allowed the city to profit from brothel services through taxes, and it gave local police the authority to close or tolerate a brothel at their discretion. An unofficial list contained the names of brothels and prostitutes regularly seen by private physicians, and those not on the list were not allowed to operate. The system primarily focused on controlling brothels, particularly the Japanese houses that served European clientele. But as Warren explains, in the Chinese brothels, venereal diseases spread as immigrant labor kept on increasing right up to the First World War. In 1912, public scandal about white slavery made popular by Mrs. Archibald McCurdy and W.N. Willis broke the white slave market, resulted in intense scrutiny of Singapore's extra-legal system, forced officials to address the legal trade in women and girls more seriously, and motivated officials to push the commercial sex industry out of public view. Anti-trafficking activists quickly took notice of Singapore's tolerated houses and began a vitriolic campaign for their abolition. Exaggerating an already dismal situation, abolitionists offered up public descriptions of miserable, drug-addicted European women who had been stolen from their houses and were in need of rescue. Even though European women were the minority in Singapore, the campaign focused on the trade's degradation of white European daughters. Social reformers used every avenue at their disposal to bring attention to the fact that British officials had allowed Singapore's authority to tolerate the system of brothels, which were notoriously responsible for the sexual exploitation of women and girls. The political pressure eventually forced the colonial office to take action, and authorities used an emergency amendment to the Women and Girls Protection Ordinance to expel all European prostitutes from the city. And by 1916, there were officially no European prostitutes in Singapore. The campaign against the white slave trade did not bring about the end of prostitution in Singapore, but the movement made it more difficult to own and run a brothel in the city. Wow, that is a very interesting chapter in Singapore's history.
It's insane because we start to see those patterns kind of stick around. The fact that it was regulated, but, you know, kept under very like hush-hush kind of terms, where we had designated brothels already in very selected areas, and they were already having like physicians. There was a whole system, right, that was in place, yet not publicly or explicitly talked about or explicitly like touted as what defined prostitution. It was just like, okay, it's here, and we will try to keep it as small as we possibly can.
There are two things that strike me about this chapter, right? The first is that within Singapore, despite the repeal of the ordinance at the level of the British government back in Britain, Singapore was like, you know, we still want to have some level of protection here, and we want to have some level of quasi-regulation, right? And they used the system of controlling brothels in order to maintain the issue. And I think some of that connects with the presence of secret societies and very strong local influencers who refused to budge. So these are pieces that we're starting to see connect. The other piece that strikes me a lot is the fact that the only reason why there was a big hoo-ha was because there was a focus on European women, right? Again, there wasn't any hoo-ha made about the fact that women from Asia were also being exploited. Women from Asia were also part of the prostitution trade. But it was primarily because it was, as they said, right, young European daughters, white European daughters that were being degraded. That is why they wanted a clean sweep. And the outcome was basically that there's just no more European prostitutes. There are still non-European prostitutes in Singapore.
It's strange because when we look at words like quasi-regulated, I sort of see it the same way we do today. It's like we haven't really shaken all of this just off. Only a very specific group of people are benefiting from this, right? Not everyone is well protected under such quasi-regulations. All right, so we're going to just take a short break and we'll be back to talk a little bit more about the 1920s, where now that, you know, the white European women are no longer prostitutes, what does it mean for Singapore as we grow towards independence? Stay tuned for that.
We're glad you're listening to this episode and are part of the SG Explainers community. You're special because you're part of a group of people who are joining us to understand the Singaporean identity through a wide variety of topics. Ali and I do this completely out of passion, but we do incur costs to use software, equipment, and not to mention the time spent. We're hoping that you may consider supporting the SG Explain effort in one of two ways. If you click on the podcast description of the podcast you're listening to, you'll see a link that says support this podcast with a link to anchor.fm/sg-explain/support. A contribution as small as 99 cents when added up by all our community members can go a long way for us. The second way is that if you want more bonus content for your buck, we've launched an email newsletter. That's right, all the content that doesn't make it to the podcast, including our own perspectives, videos, and pictures, as well as links to more resources, can be found in these email digests that provide compact information for your on-the-go reading. For $5 a month, basically the cost of a bubble tea, through Substack you can get a digest a week with great content. The internet has allowed you, the consumer, to directly express your support to creators like us without needing to depend on brand sponsors too much. We hope you can give whatever you feel comfortable with. Here at SG Explained, Elliot and I are committed to getting great guests, conducting thorough research, and bringing you quality explainers on all things Singaporean. Thank you for being part of our community. And we're back from the break. Welcome back. We're going to be looking at the 1920s and how prostitution looked like in this era of Singapore's history. Now, in the 1920s, Chinatown was flooded with tea houses, theaters, opium dens tended by young sing-song girls, locally known as Pei Pa Chai or Pei Pa Girls. So in the 1800s, we heard about the Akus and the Japanese Karayuki-sans. And now in the 1920s, we're getting introduced to a new category of girls called the Pipa girls. And these girls were paid by the hour by rich clients to play mahjong or prepare opium. Many in due course were lured into prostitution. And these prostitutes mainly came from China, Japan, and even Europe. Though there were no British prostitutes, again, due to the ban imposed. The National Heritage Board describes the life of a prostitute in colonial Singapore as horrendous. Once in a brothel, the girls were often subjected to beatings and received little or no medical attention. Riddled with diseases, these pitiful women were often also murder victims. Seeing no other escape from their living hell, a number of these prostitutes took their own lives. While some threw themselves off buildings, others preferred a more subtle method, an opium overdose, informs the National Heritage Board in one of the placards placed in Chinatown. By 1923, there were 423 government-run shops selling opium over-the-counter between 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. But in brothels, opium would be available till 2 a.m.
When we talked about opium the last time, during like things like the Merchant episode and even during like the secret societies, we know how much of an addiction opium can give to the user. So we're kind of going to look at like the kinds of brothels and how they were run back in the day. As Rovik mentioned, you know, there were like Chinese brothels, and then there were also like the Japanese brothels. The most infamous street at the turn of the 20th century was Smith Street, right? Which was lined with 25 three- and four-story shophouses packed with prostitutes. While two were Japanese, most of the other brothels here were Chinese, and with the most notorious being number 65. Its owner was this lady named Lo Sai So, who was stabbed when she attempted to stop a customer from leaving without paying. The street served as a red light area between 1901 and 1930. And adjoining Smith Street was Temple Street, which got its name after the Sri Mariam Temple, located at one of the street, and was also famous for its Chinese brothel. So we are no strangers to these locations. Every time we talk about like early Singapore, right, it always happens that somewhere around that Temple Street, Ang Siang Hill area, mm-hmm. there's always going to be some sort of vice going on. We always alluded to them in previous episodes, but we never really got into the heart of a story such as this. So on the other hand, also known as Yap Pun Kai, or the lane of foreign prostitutes, or sometimes even known as Japanese Street. This street hosted the few Japanese brothels in colonial Singapore. Notably, until like the pre-war years, Japanese prostitutes piled their trade along this street in an oddly noble effort to help finance their country's military campaign. So this is called the National Heritage Board, by the way. It's very interesting that they were trying to raise money via prostitution so that as we go into the World War later on, they had funds to send back home. Another street notorious for Japanese brothels till 1930 was the Banda Street, which is located at the junction of Sago Street, Sago Lane and Spring Street.
I think it's worth calling out that the presence of Japanese prostitutes is very surprising, right? So European prostitutes, we understand because of the British. Chinese prostitutes, we understand because of the clans. But the presence of Japanese prostitutes is very interesting. And I'm sure there's some nexus to the clans and the triads, you know, wanting a foothold in Singapore. But at the same time, you know, when we think of the Japanese in Singapore, we normally tend to think of World War II, right? But to know that there was a history even before World War II when the Japanese were present, and I'm sure it wasn't just the prostitutes, I'm sure there were others as well. But to know that they existed in Singapore is definitely new for me and something that I'll definitely, you know, keep in mind.
I tried to find out more about like Japanese prostitutes in Singapore, even like pre-war, and it was very difficult to find like a root trace. I probably have to dig up a little bit more in the future.
Now, in the late 1920s, an increasingly powerful nationalist movement and political tensions motivated the Japanese government to make efforts to have all the citizens removed from Singapore and sent back to Japan. With the help of the British Parliament, the Japanese consul took steps to deport all Karayuki-san from the colony. And although Japan had profited from their sexual labor for more than 20 years, Karayuki-san were forced out of Singapore and went back to generally unwelcoming communities in Japan. Now, that makes sense because there's, of course, always going to be a stigma against prostitutes. And to know that, you know, there were certain women who went out and mixed around with people from different countries and then came back, I think it's definitely, you can imagine the level of discrimination they probably faced.
Definitely. One of the stigmas that, you know, the Japanese, even in current modern day Japan, is that Japanese prostitutes generally don't solicit with gaijin or like outsiders. So I can only imagine what that stigma was like in like the 1920s.
Exactly. So some Karayuki-san protested and challenged the local government's authority to force them out. Others stayed due to outstanding debts or because they had a venereal disease, while others disappeared into the city and sold sex privately to earn a living. Those taken back to Japan were left on the docks with no financial assistance or means of support. With few economic options left open to them, some followed the Japanese army as they prepared to invade China. Many committed suicide as a result of shame from discrimination and lack of opportunity. And nonetheless, neither the efforts of the British authorities nor the Japanese government could completely eliminate the populations of Karayuki-san working in Singapore's sex market. Groups such as the Association for Moral and Social Hygiene continued to critique the tolerated prostitution system, which gained new support as venereal diseases spread rapidly during World War I. Increased overhead costs, scrutiny from local authorities, and the mass deportation of Japanese prostitutes also pushed many Aku, which are the Chinese prostitutes, underground and initiated a dramatic rise in clandestine prostitution in the city. The combination of high fees and taxes required to run a brothel forced many of the Chinese establishments to close. And at the same time, the removal of the Karayuki-san encouraged more Eurasian, Malay, and Thai women to enter into Singapore's now clandestine sex market. As a result, many women went to work at coffee shops, tea houses, markets, laundry shops, and eating houses and offered sexual services on the side. The surreptitious manner in which they worked also meant that they did not have the same open access to medical services they had during regulationism, and many saw regular checkups as an easily avoidable financial imposition. Basically, they wanted to avoid more costs. Thus, the steady stream of military troops that flowed into the barracks and clandestine brothels during and after the war took a variety of venereal diseases back home with them. So we're starting to see, you know, as World War I comes in, as the Japanese women are sent back, as the Chinese women go underground because of, you know, the conservative movement starting to push against regulation of prostitution, as well as the fact that the mismatch between demand and supply caused Eurasian, Malay, and Thai women to enter. You have this mismatch of, you know, secret underground activities where people aren't going to get their health check. You don't really know who's a prostitute. You can't even observe like where people are going to visit prostitutes, right? Because they're all over the city. And so you can't localize, you can't control the issue. And venereal diseases just start to to spread like crazy.
Exactly. And it's all in the name of survival, right? So like you kind of mentioned, I think the rates of urinary infection in Singapore then, as a consequence of this, reached like epidemic levels. And by like the 1920s, local authorities scrambled for ways to control it. Appealing to the colonial office, Singapore's officials once again proposed a new system of brothel regulation reminiscent of the 1870 ordinances. However, changes in the political leadership and sentiment resulted in very little support for state-sanctioned and controlled prostitution. Seizing the opportunity, social reformers called attention to the epidemic and pushed for abolition. By 1927, officials attempted to eliminate professional prostitution in Singapore without actually prohibiting the practice, but by implementing a ban on the immigration of known prostitutes. So it wasn't about controlling locally what was happening. It was about preventing that next wave of immigrants to come in. Cut off the practice at its trafficking roots, so to speak. Additionally, authorities made brothels illegal, and by 1930, Singapore's notorious brothel districts were closed. Many women returned home to their countries, found jobs as servants, cooks, washwomen, or even they married their former clients. While others tried their luck in the underground market, since the act of selling sexual services was still, you know, supposedly legal, we're starting to see this whole idea of they know that they can't really clamp down on activity here. It's like people would just hide underground. They would find other ways to sell their services.
And this ban against known prostitutes continues to this day. A lot of the laws that we know today in Singapore, they are inherited from the British time. And one of it is basically the ban against the immigration of prostitutes. So if you get caught as a prostitute in Singapore, you are not allowed to re-enter as well, because you are then deemed as a prostitute who may be working professionally and they want to curb the immigration of prostitutes. Let's go on to the next chapter, which is in post-colonial Singapore. So the Second World War had brought another influx of military battalions onto the island and generated a dramatic increase in the number of brothels, prostitutes, and outbreak of venereal infections. While we're talking about World War II, I just thought to mention this really, really good book written by Jingjing Li about essentially the Singaporean scene during World War II and how there were a number of women who were taken away, right? Singaporean women taken away and made as comfort women for the Japanese. And the book's name is called How We Disappeared. I highly recommend it. Definitely go borrow it, because I think we forget that, you know, there were women who were basically raped systematically in Singapore, and they were basically forced into these prostitution houses, forced into these brothels as a way to satisfy the need of these uncouth men. It's a reminder again of the dangers of unregulated or even uncontrolled brothels and prostitutes. So the revitalization of the industry after World War II led Singapore's authorities to once again rethink their policies. Between 1930 and 1960, local officials changed their focus from abolition to containment in an effort to curb the spread of diseases and the abuse suffered by women. Underground brothel prostitution had survived, and by the time Singapore gained independence in 1959 and formed an independent government in 1963, the old colonial red light districts thrived and serviced men from around the world. Regulations against maintaining brothels, soliciting and zoning ordinances, which quarantined the commercial sex sector in specific parts of the city, pushed Singapore's trade out of public view, but made a way for a new extra-legal system that accommodated the persistent demand. This change initiated an entirely new organizational structure in Singapore's sex market. The elimination of secret societies alongside this, which we, you know, go check out our special episode, did remove much of the coercion that existed in brothels, and availability of other work made prostitution, at least for local women, more of a personal choice rather than an economic choice. Nonetheless, an underground trade in trafficked women and girls still exists in Singapore, and authorities have only been minimally successful at suppressing it. The economic boom that occurred between 1970 and 1990 created another surge in demand for Singapore's commercial sex trade, and a recession in the 1980s during the Asian financial crisis brought a new supply of unskilled Malay women unable to find factory or manufacturing work, and women from rural India migrating to Singapore with their children to work as prostitutes trying to support their families. In the urban center, Chinese women are still the dominant ethnicity among Singapore's commercial sex workers. However, an increase in construction and the result of an explosion in tourism in the 1990s drew in increasing numbers of Korean and Thai prostitutes now, who made money following the pool of single men working in these sectors. The primary centers of prostitution are the designated red light areas where in the 1990s, women earned between $7 and $120 per client for a variety of sexual services. And these designated red light areas are, you know, Geylang. There are some parts of Little India, right? I remember Desker Road was designated as one of these. There's Orchard for some areas as well.
And Joo Chiat, even in the Katong side of things.
Right, when we did the Katong episode.
Katong episode, yeah. I didn't know when that turn occurred. You know, I thought it was during like globalization. But in a strange sense, we've always been a hub for it. And it's always been a draw factor for some of these people. In spite of the decades of legislation, I think there remains a teeming commercial sex market in Singapore. According to researchers Shabala Nagaraj and Siti Rohani Yaya, since laws prohibit the use of premises for prostitution, most legal establishments tend to observe the rules and to keep the business of commercial sex independent of their operations. Their study is called Prostitution in Malaysia, and it examines Singapore's sex industry extensively as part of the Malayan Peninsula and describes the development of the sex sector. They illustrate the role Singapore's sex sector plays as a central economic feature of the island. For example, the freelancers and special workers operate in dance halls, nightclubs, karaoke lounges, supper clubs, and there are some strip clubs and lounges where clients pay for nude dances, even touching and other forms of sexual intimacy. The women might be contracted by the house or work independently, but they negotiate intercourse outside their duties as employees. So it kind of has this distinction between what your job is and whatever extra services. As we talked about prostitution earlier on, it was about penetration, right? Like by definition. So taxi drivers were important links for sex workers in an era of increased police raids and underground prostitution, where drivers are regularly a client's connection to clubs, establishments, and streets where sexual services were offered. This was something I thought was extremely interesting. Yeah, I did not know there was a network of these things happening.
In other major capitals of the world or major hubs of the world, taxi drivers and even hotel concierges, you know, in some city parts of the world are known as part of this network as well. You know, you have all these rich, high net worth clients coming through and they'll basically tip and pay for such things anyway.
And they benefit off of this as well, right? So like there is a whole economical structure to this actually. Well, this same study also explains that commercial sex workers in Singapore are classified by either their means of procurement or their employment status. So what this means is like using methods of procurement as categories, Singapore's prostitutes work as market prostitutes, you know, so that's considered the lowest rung of the earnings ladder in the local markets. Secondly, street walkers who are more mobile and advertise inconspicuously to avoid solicitation charges. And then next level, there is the employed commercial sex worker or those who are employed by an establishment rather than working independently. And then we have the massage parlor, bar or nightclub workers, freelancers, and the special workers, also known as social escorts. So those are set right at the top. However, the employment status and full or part-time work are also important factors, you see. So prostitutes in the primitive labor market, such as the street workers and clandestine brothel workers who worked full-time, earned the least and were at the bottom of the hierarchy, while the enterprise labor market included women working at massage parlors, taverns, so like hotels and stuff, and lounges, and they generally worked part-time and had more autonomy in stipulating their prices and choosing clientele. So in today's scenario, these seem to be like the freelance workers. There are a lot more freelance workers who work online, right? And that is their way of having a very similar thing. They're part-timers, they have more autonomy, and they can set their own prices because they are in charge of what they advertise. And finally, those who are self-employed, the call girls and special escorts were generally people who earned the most. Ranging in age from like their early teens to even seniors, many of these women, according to Nagaraj and Yaya, willingly entered prostitution, while others were sold or forced into the business by family members, spouses, or boyfriends. And while the above categories are definitely, you know, problematic, they are descriptive categories that give us an idea of the ways sex workers have adapted to legislative prohibitions while continuing to accommodate customer demands.
You know, I think as two males talking about this topic, right, Elliot, it's yes, definitely very troubling sometimes to read through these things, right? Because first of all, as long as you go through the national service program and you mingle with all kinds of males, you definitely meet guys who you know go out, they find prostitutes. In fact, some of them, they may not even see these women as prostitutes, right? They see these women as companions. That's because of a range of different factors, including self-esteem, loneliness, etc. I'll even admit that sometimes you'll just be out on the street and you'll hear a couple of your friends say like, oh, that's definitely, you know, a hooker or a prostitute or you know, some of these terms that they use. And so they are quite obvious in Singapore, I think, especially if you open your eyes, these massage parlors, these bars, some of these quote-unquote streetwalkers. It's a bit ludicrous to continue to believe that, you know, the trade doesn't happen in Singapore, or there isn't, you know, quote-unquote, this level of hierarchy as well. Because as the research has shown, like, these women face different kinds of struggles, whether it's, you know, some level of you know, consistency in pay or, you know, protection via their establishment. And it does show how we've evolved to today's time. And we'll talk a bit about online prostitution and how the internet has also just enabled a new set of access for women who may not even see themselves as traditional prostitutes, right? Whether it's even, you know, on the closer side of the spectrum, so like online escorts, all the way down to like, you know, would you consider OnlyFans or campsites within the realm, right? And in the West, they put these workers together as sex workers.
It's very common for us to talk about it now, where we say, like, we mentioned Orchard Towers, for example. It's right in the heart of the city. It's well known as being a place where there are a lot of these prostitution works that just happen, right? And people regularly visit it either to eat or to visit these places.
So there are a few women in Singapore who are full-time employees with specified duties, leave, and employment benefits, and whose sexual labor is contracted on the side. However, most prostitutes in Singapore work in brothels or as independent agents. And according to a 1992 study, so this is still quite a while ago, averaged about $28 per client and around $1,400 a month. There was a remarkable disparity between the highest earners making $11,000 a month and the lowest making a mere pittance of $40 per month. As one would imagine, the same contingencies of youth, beauty, ethnicity, which are very visceral and surface level definitions of beauty, determine the value of these women's bodies. Older prostitutes are not able to charge as much as younger women, but young women who are deemed unappealing are also limited in how much they can charge. Additionally, the researchers explained that transvestites and transsexuals form a special category because they cater mainly to homosexual clients and generally use prostitution as a primary means of support. They are outcasts where homosexuality is a punishable crime, and they are often subject to even more harassment and abuse. The researchers also found that there was a small population of male prostitutes in Singapore who are generally frequented by wealthy women, work in exclusive locations, and charge exorbitant rates. As one of the only studies even making mention of male transsexual or child prostitution, it is clear that these areas need further investigation. There are still several local ordinances and acts, like we've mentioned before, that prohibit various aspects of the sex trade, like the Women's Charter in the Penal Code and the Public Order Act. But the primary concern at the moment is the active movement of underage girls being trafficked into the market. In July of 2012, after a series of public scandals about underage prostitution, freelance journalist Paul Fitzpatrick wrote an article for the Singapore Business Review exposing the character of prostitution in Singapore. And unknowingly, the journalist described what for Singapore had become a curiously familiar pattern. He reported that while they are not legal, the police unofficially tolerate and monitor a limited number of brothels. Street girls and ding-dong girls and package women and second wives and female companions are some of the many options that exist in Singapore for commercial sex. Women continue to use prostitution as a means to compensate for the difficulty of finding other employment because, as we mentioned, they come into Singapore trafficked, right? They are promised a job in an attractive place like Singapore where there's a lot of opportunities, but because of all the fees that it takes to come here and because most of the time the effort it takes to find them a job or to get them the papers that they need, all of that falls through, then they need to pay back these debts through prostitution.
With such like detailed descriptions of this underground and, you know, very so-called nefarious trade, I think it's important to not assume that all sex workers have been trafficked, coerced, or forced into the business. Prostitution can be a lucrative business, and Singapore's growth and prosperity, along with the notoriety of its red light districts, have drawn professional prostitutes from around the world for more than a century. The number of men passing through the international entrepôt have promised both security of employment and the potential for prosperity. Nonetheless, Singapore's authorities have historically battled the illegal trade in women and girls who are unwillingly trafficked into Singapore's brothels. As smugglers have supplied young women and girls, either indentured or sold outright. And in Singapore, since the beginning of the 19th century, in spite of local and political and legal authorities' efforts to stop it. In fact, in an article in the Jakarta Globe claims that in 2008, officials tightened laws to combat human trafficking, and Singapore's authorities recently uncovered a ring of vice syndicates providing patrons with underage girls. After discussing all of this today, Rovix, it's good for two of us. You mentioned how we're just two males in Singapore, locals, who are trying to wrap our heads on this huge topic of prostitution. There is like the stigma of it. There is the exploitation of women. There is this whole idea that it's linked with our colonial past or even pre-colonial past. I just thought it would be nice for us to take some time to, you know, just have a few reflective thoughts about it.
I'll raise 3 points, right? I think the first is about the internet. I just wanted to say that with the internet, I think it's important to realize that prostitution looks in very different ways these days, right? So there are a couple of different websites out there which state actually how the law applies to online services. I thought one that was interesting was IRB Law, which basically states that under the amendments in 2016 to Section 146A of the Women's Charter, it is now an offense for a person in Singapore to operate or maintain in Singapore a remote communication service, which includes websites, that offers or facilitates the provision by a woman or girl to another person of sexual services in return for payment or reward. There are a couple of catalog websites or even like simple like list websites where you can just Google and find online escorts, right? And these are illegal under Singapore, and it's because it is essentially a form of digital pimping. It is even more dangerous because it's anonymous. You don't know where these women are from. You don't know whether they are getting, you know, health checked. And basically allowing this to be under the scope of the Women's Charter allows the police to go in and take action, which I think is a very good idea. But then you also, I mean, the internet is a monster, right? And so you don't actually know how to keep up sometimes with the changing platforms. And so, like I mentioned, OnlyFans, right? So, Elliot, you mentioned that there are women who also choose to enter into sex work, right? Either because they consider it a dignified way of earning money. And, you know, I can totally respect and see that point of view. But it also has the section of a woman who feel pressured, right? Who face social stigma, who may not really fully understand the implications of what it means to put yourself on the internet. And I think that's something else to keep in mind. I'll openly admit that my position on this is evolving. It's, you know, I'm thinking about it, I'm talking to people about it, but I think it's just something we need to keep in mind as the nature of sex work evolves. The second piece I want to talk about is about human trafficking. And I think it's important to recognize that Singapore has unfortunately played a key note in human trafficking before. We used to be tier two in the US Trafficking in Persons Report because we did not fully meet the minimum standards. Right now, thankfully, we are tier one, which means that we do meet the minimum standards under, and we follow the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which basically works with other pre-existing trafficking laws and makes benefits available to victims of trafficking. We do not have specific laws to prevent trafficking, but it has laws to protect people that may be in the world of human trafficking. And so we are in this interesting space where we need to think about the intersection of prostitution and trafficking. And, you know, unfortunately, we can't go into the whole realm of trafficking, but as we've alluded to it and we've kind of talked about it a couple of times, it has a very strong intersection with the prostitution topic. The last thing then is to talk about what it means for our national identity. I think it's a mixed bag, just as secret societies are and just as some of the other topics we've done are. On one hand, it helps us realize that Singapore isn't necessarily all clean and green.
We still retain parts of the Chicago of the East.
Yeah, exactly. And that means that we have to not take things for granted, right?
Yeah, we have to be vigilant about the way we approach these things, especially now that you mentioned like what it means for our national identity. I think it resonates very strongly with me. It requires us to always scrutinize and really think about our actions and the way we're willing to voice about certain things. When it comes to prostitution in particular, you know, I've heard so many different, and my position has changed so many times across the past, 30 years of my life, just thinking about sex work is work too in my eyes today. But there is also a whole viewpoint of exploitation and the way, you know, the internet can mold minds, especially young minds in this day and age. And that is very hard to regulate, right? Our consumption of the internet is hard to regulate. So what does it mean to be a youth, an 18-year-old girl in this day and age? It's not just about, like, you know, about pressure in terms of body image, but it is a lot of money. When people report about things on OnlyFans, they're saying, whoa, I'm earning a good $10,000 a month just by posting pictures online or videos online. It's worth taking a look. I'm not sure what's right or what's wrong, but I'm constantly thinking about it just as you are.
You know, when we do topics like this, I think we end up in this place, right? Because the space is current. It's not a historical episode that just existed in the past. It is still live and well. And I think the starting point for it is to acknowledge that we have questions and we're curious and we want to learn more. So if you are a listener and you have something to add, or you have a perspective to share on this, please reach out, send us a message. You know, I think there's definitely a lot of room for growth in this space.
With that, I think we've come to the end of a pretty long episode. I think it's a very big topic and a nice way to start off season 4. So I'd like to thank everyone for sticking through with us. Thank you for joining us today. We have a lot of fun episodes coming up in the rest of the season. Not all of them is going to be as heavy as this, and we have a lot of special guests lined up as well.